Welcome back, everybody, for another episode of Confident ROI, the one show you can confidently listen to get a real return on your investment. From the man who's worked in companies, worked on companies, and worked with companies, can share the tools and ideas that he's seen from all three, it's Alex Voropiev. Hey, Alex.
Hey, Paul.
So where are we at today? We always have to say, it's like, where's Waldo today here?
Yeah, just I'm at the Northern Command. Well, I'm in the Northern Front. I'm not in my home office.
Okay. You're in a bunker with a bunch of other thought leaders. You've been isolated from the world. You're trying to solve all the problems here?
Well, we got a couple firsts. We're at the first time Confident ROI's out in the field.
Oh, okay. A roving field reporter here.
In a company's headquarters, and not only just any company, but the company more responsible for my successful move, my family's successful move to Boise, Idaho, the Treasure Valley.
Okay.
This company was...
Now, this isn't going to be like the siren song where you're going to try and entice us all to leave California and move up there, are you?
I don't think I'm going to have to try that hard.
It sells itself, huh?
Well, it does, because one of the things, I'm down there on a monthly basis, and every time I tell somebody I've escaped, they want to know more.
How did you do it? Escape from Alcatraz. How did you do it? Right.
And they want to. When I tell them I moved to Idaho, they're even more interested. And it's the fastest growing state now, according to the Wall Street Journal. And so a lot's going on.
Okay.
And there was a company, Wheezy Bishop, is the real estate firm that I use to help our family relocate up here. And it wasn't the first agent that I work with, but John Vandergeesen, who's an agent with them, he's here with me today, as well as Scott Bishop. And I wanted him to have him on the show so that we could hear more about Idaho, because it's interesting. And they've grown a successful firm even before the growth. And now, being in the right place at the right time, what are they doing to capture that growth? What business tools are working? So for today, we're gonna cover two topics, both geography as well as growing a business when things move in the right direction as well.
Okay, launch away here. I'm all ears.
All right, they can't hear our chat, so they're looking at me like I'm just having a conversation with myself. So. Welcome to the show, Scott Bishop and John Vandergeesen.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Welcome to Confident ROI, our first on-location broadcast from outside of California.
Wow, this is an honor. Milestone. This is awesome.
Yeah, I know the California Franchise Tax Board is trying to figure out, you know, how they could tax this at this moment.
They're going to reach those tentacles out and grab you.
Somebody's calculating something right now.
I'm sure. They're plotting down there.
Yeah, they always are. I was just yesterday. I went to my new dentist, and the dentist was from California, and the hygienist was from California, and it's really easy to get to talk to people around here, because somebody's had some relationship with California, and they treat you pretty well. But Scott or John, why don't you? How fast is Boise and Idaho and Treasure Valley growth?
It's moving. It's growing pretty fast. As you mentioned, the Wall Street Journal gave us, I think, the number one state in terms of growth. That's a percentage number, because we're a small population, so it's not as hard for us to grow high percentages. But you feel it. I mean, you can see, you know, there's construction all over the place. Traffic, the locals are feeling that. So there's a little bit of blowback, of course. When things are slow, they're begging for people to come here and bring their business. And then when it gets busy and traffic gets crazy, they're like, what is going on? Who are all these damn Californians? Of course, Californians get the blame. So, it's been exciting. We've been doing real estate here in Boise since the early 90s. So we've seen a couple cycles here in the market. So we've seen both sides. So it's been good.
And what's drawing people to Boise?
I would say it's the whole package. It's the lifestyle package, where you have a small town But it still has the those amenities that you want to have in your community. You know, we've actually got a Whole Foods you can go to. So you've got the restaurants, you've got entertainment. Probably more importantly, you've got the recreational activities that people love. You've got the rivers, you've got the mountains, biking, hiking, skiing, you know, all seasons. It's a place where you've got quick access to the things that people want to do, you know. Whereas when you're in the Bay Area, for example, you know, just getting out of the Bay Area in a couple hours is a big deal. Getting to Tahoe on a weekend is not an easy task anymore, you know. So if you could get, you know, from downtown Boise, you can be to the top of Bogus in roughly 30 minutes, 25 minutes, and come literally this doesn't happen every year, but there can be years where you're golfing in the morning, skiing in the afternoon, or vice versa. So it's a unique climate here.
And for folks that don't know, Bogus Basin is the local ski resort. Of course, we have Sun Valley, we have Brundage, we have a lot of great mountains in Idaho, but those are a little bit further away. But, you know, from my house and, you know, Scott's house as well, you know, it's 16 miles to hit the slopes and get on the chair. So, I mean, even if you're just going to get a couple of runs in at lunch, you know, when you're working downtown or whatever, I mean, that's a pretty big thing. And I also want to add that we do have indoor plumbing, because that has been asked by folks from, you know, other states. You know, my friend Mike in Brooklyn, he was convinced we didn't have indoor plumbing. So I can assure you that's not the case. We're equipped here.
Yeah.
But that came here in the mid-90s, right?
It's a recent thing. We're excited about it.
There's a lot to do. What I've noticed too is there's a lot of companies here. Yeah. And there's a lot. What's driving that? Is there anything you guys have seen that's bringing companies? It seems like they're bringing jobs here.
Yeah, I think for the same reasons we talked about. You know, it's interesting. Back when in the 70s, I think HP came here for that exact reason. You know, so they brought their printer division here, which was thriving when HP was thriving. That's not so much the case anymore. But I think, you know, we don't have a lot of big companies, but I think you're seeing a lot of smaller companies with a few big companies. And that's a great foundation by my estimation, when you've got a lot of small companies and small entrepreneurs that want to build something here. And that's kind of the mindset for a lot of these guys that are, you know, doing their little startups here. You know, rather than going to Silicon Valley, they're like, we can make this happen here. The biggest challenge is there's, you know, getting the people, because there's, even though we've got a lot of people coming in, you're like, it's hard to find good talent right now in almost every field, I would say. So in fact, it was interesting. We're having a shortage of just general labor, right? And I was down in San Diego with some friends of ours who happen to run a tile company. And I'm like, man, you guys must be having the same, like, you know, labor shortage. I'm like, huh? We ran an ad the other day for a tile guy, got 400 applicants. I'm like, God, we gotta come down here and advertise for people. Plus, they're getting paid higher up here by quite a bit, and of course, the cost of living is quite lower. So you've got this weird inversion thing happening, where I don't know. I guess the word just hasn't gotten out that you can actually make more and pay less up here.
That's the first time I've heard there's been a surplus of labor in any field, subfield,
in California. What? Maybe I just hit a unique spot,
because yeah,
they're a commercial tile company. So I don't know if that's across the board.
You wonder if there's some slowdown there, because there's so much in the trades nowadays is busy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're for sure feeling it here. I mean, since the crash, you know, back in the 2007, 2008, 2009, a lot of the labor, construction labor, fled the market and went to other places. And we just haven't been able to get it back in sufficient quantities to be able to keep up with demand. So it's a problem.
Alex, I also want to add another dynamic that's kind of been, you know, gaining momentum. I've probably been for some time in California, newer here, but I'm seeing a lot of folks work remotely. You know, clients from Oracle, you know, a lot of different folks coming into the area that can just work at home. Higher level people, they have the opportunity to work from home now, and they're voting with their dollar for a play on lifestyle. They hear some things, you know, about how good it is, and I think I liken it to probably the wagon train. When people heard about California, or, you know, just moving west, and they want to have a little piece of that, and now that's flipped and people are kind of leaving places like California and looking for, you know, greener pastures and lifestyle, whatever that means to them in places like Boise.
Yeah, for me, it was the density. I wanted to try living in a place that didn't have as high a density. And because you got a dichotomy about living in a big metropolitan market like Los Angeles, in that you really have to plan when you're going to move around during the day. Mm. You know, if you got to go to the other side of LA, if you got to go to the valley, you gotta leave 5 a.m. and you need to get back on the road before 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock, or it's going to take 2 or 3 hours, or you got to wait till 7, 8 o'clock at night to drive back. So it's just kind of a dichotomy of the density. Yeah, there's more people there and there's more, sometimes there's more business meetings, but to take those meetings is sometimes more difficult.
Yeah, absolutely.
In that, we have seen that on the airplanes. There's a lot of people commuting that work here most of the time, and they need to go to San Francisco or Orange County to have a meeting to check in with the home office. But that remote is working. I find that I use Zoom all the time now, and you're gonna have a nice visual conversation with somebody at marginally no cost.
Yeah.
Why don't we shift here? You know, people can, they're interested in Idaho. It's not Iowa, people. It's Idaho. Iowa's in the Midwest. But Idaho, John, you helped me get up to speed on Boise and Treasure Valley, things that I just didn't understand. How do you help people learn about it and determine whether or not this might be a fit for them?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, as an agent on the ground, I mean, Scott's kind of more at 30,000 feet and doing a lot of things behind the scenes. And, you know, I'm in the day-to-day production. And, you know, what I've found in real estate, you know, when we're, you know, bringing a lot of value to clients, it's about being a pathfinder, being a tour guide, you know, making sure that everybody gets clarity and finding what they want. And, you know, quite often, you know, people do find what they're looking for here and they get clarity with that. Sometimes they figure out that Idaho's not for them and they need something else, and that's great. And that's my biggest value piece, is just finding that clarity, helping them get clear on what's important to them and you know, does Idaho and does Boise meet their needs or exceed them most of the time, or does it not? And then after that, we can have a great experience just kind of finding the right neighborhoods. And, you know, do you want to be close to the Rich Rivers Trail system, or do you want to have a little bit more acreage out in Eagle, or, you know, gosh, what kind of lifestyle do you want? And let me help you find that. And that's where people get the most benefit from me. So.
Yeah, I think people have a fear or just a sense of, hey, is it time to work with a real estate agent? And it's my first time up here, or, you know, been up here skiing one time and that. And so how do you put people at ease with that?
You know, I just say, look, you're just fact finding right now. You're not committing to anything other than just finding some things out. And let's just start with that and see what happens. Okay. And most of the time, that kind of initial sales situation just kind of drops, and it's more about, I'm going to help you. And, you know, if you end up buying here, that's wonderful. But if not, that's okay too. And I'm just very transparent about that. I think that's what you have to be, you know, as a great real estate agent.
How do you guys help people understand, is Boise all the same, or is there different aspects of it? Anything that you, how do you help people look in the right direction? I mean, what's the size of the valley from end to end here? They call it the Treasure Valley. I don't know why, but I know it has water. I can water my lawn for free.
Right. You can dip on that.
Well, so the Treasure Valley encompasses, you know, Boise all the way out to Napa-Caldwell area. So it is just literally that. It's a big valley. I think when the reason it's called Boise is because when the fur traders, you know, the French fur traders were out here, they came over the ridge and just saw this big valley of trees. So Le Bois is the forest in French. And so that's what it was. It was just a beautiful valley, river running through the middle of it. And therefore the Treasure Valley name probably came, you know, it's a valley of treasure, came along at some point. But population, I think, what are we?
I think in the valley total, so we're even outside of Ada County, we're looking at something like 675,000 with a projection of 1 million people by 2040. And that makes some of the listeners laugh, I'm sure, because there's a lot more than 1 million people in just cities in California, let alone a whole valley that, you know, really goes from Boise to the border of Oregon and Idaho. So it's a pretty big space, to say the least.
That's like 30 miles, right?
From Yeah, roughly.
But the French, I mean, that you didn't tell me about the French.
I
thought it was the Boise Indian tribe, but it's but it's a takeoff on the French.
Yeah, it's a French word. Yeah, French fur trappers were out here. There were native tribes in the area for sure, hunting, living, fishing, gathering.
So it's like Boise.
Yeah.
That,
no wonder my wife likes it.
The reason it's an interesting spot in history, just because it's very mild here, and this was a big trade destination for Native Americans and fur traders and settlers, mountain men. You know, everybody would come here. And now we're a viticultural area. People always ask me, "Well, what about the snow?" And they think that it's going to be like the Great Lakes or something. And you know, if we're growing wine grapes here, people, it's not. It's just not that bad. I mean, yeah, we do have a white Christmas. You can get up to big snow quite quickly, but down here in the valley, it's great. It's really mild.
Now, is that the mountain range is just to the north? Does that kind of keep the really bitter cold? Because Sun Valley gets a lot colder, right?
Yeah, they're higher elevation. Their floor is 6,000 feet, and we're at 2,500 down here.
Yeah, we're river level down here, so yeah, it's mild. And we don't have a lot of precipitation. We're a high plateau desert, and we get 11 inches of precipitation a year, so it's pretty dry. And it's an interesting transition zone because the foothills that you see every day, Alex, those are the start of the largest wildland space in the lower 48. And then the desert that we're down here in, that goes all the way to Las Vegas. So, I mean, this is a big transition zone. It's almost like Boulder, to be honest, where you have the start of the Flatirons and the Rocky Mountains and the Great Plains, too.
A nice transition area.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, it's time for our first break, and then we'll come back and go deeper into Boise and growing a firm in a place that's growing fastest in the nation.
Okay, I know everybody's expecting an ad from the Greater Chamber of Commerce here in the Boise area, but let's instead focus on the magazine everybody's talking about, Confident ROI. Yes. You can confidently now pick up and read the publication in print. You don't have to just tune in every week and get snippets of it. You can hold it in your hand and confidently open, knowing that there's all sorts of articles in there, like Vern Harnish, the great Vern Harnish on strategy, top grading with Dr. Brad Smart, and cures for your hiring headache. Lots of interesting articles that help you discover the right tool to improve your company. If you want to start doing that, if that sounds intriguing, go check it out. It's free. Yes, I said the four-letter word, F-R-E-E. And you can find it at confidentroi.com. That's confidentroi.com. Okay, back to Alex and his guests. Can I ask a question before you launch into your next...
You can, but they can't hear you, so I'll have to translate.
Okay. You know, I'm looking at the bigger social trends. And I'm a student of history. So when the Industrial Revolution started, they didn't have big factories. They farmed that out. It was called piecework. And somebody sewed over here and somebody knitted over here. And then they came and assembled it all in some factory. And then the last 100 years, we've moved people off of the farms and into big cities because we wanted to centralize them. Central big factories where they could have big machines and economy of scale. But now we seem with the internet and with all the tools that it's empowered, we're sort of going back to this piecemeal approach where people are moving away from the center and yet can still contribute and operate. Is that a trend that you're seeing, or am I just romanticizing what's happening here?
No, I think you hit it on the nail, hit the head on the hammer on the
I hit
nail.
Something with something here. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I had a I'm still recovering from my red eye flight home. But Paul is asking about this decentralization with the industrial revolution. You know, everything came together, but now we're seeing people from Oracle and companies like that moving out. They don't have to live necessarily next door to the home office to work. And so that's, I think that's what you guys are seeing here. And it's how I'm able to work here.
Right. Yeah. There's been, and that's been a trend that's been growing for a while. This ability to work remotely, live where you want to live.
And you're doubling down on lifestyle. And I would probably argue that companies that they're involved in are seeing an uptick in productivity and overall satisfaction too. So,
well, and there's another issue though, Paul. They handed me breaking news here.
Breaking news. Yes.
There's breaking news actually via California. It was tweeted back. Hashtag breaking. About 100 goats are on the loose right now in Boise neighborhood. They're going house to house eating everything in sight.
There is a problem in paradise.
Well, but actually, John will explain, the goats here are actually used as part of
Fire mitigation, actually, because we have the Boise foothills that we've mentioned that are great. However, we're a dry climate, and sometimes people, you know, for fire mitigation and making sure that, you know, your house doesn't burn down in the event that a fire does occur, we have what's called rent-a-goat, and there's a couple of different companies around, and I think it's like $1 per day per goat, and they'll come with a herder, and you know, it's a real professional outfit, if you will, and somebody's being quite entrepreneurial, but they'll, you know, the goats just take care of all that underbrush and you know, make a little fire barrier.
Hey, Alex, I have to mention one of the, you threw another word in there that many Californians don't understand. You said a strange word. You said you can water your lawn. What's a lawn?
Well, let me get to the lawn thing in a second. Let me just finish with the goats, because I'm also concerned that we've just triggered all the PETA people in Southern California, because having goats, sacrificing goats so that there won't be a fire, I just have a sense that that's not going to go over well in California, and that they're probably not paying these goats a livable wage as well. So it is definitely a different lifestyle here, and live and let live, and let nature, use nature in the right, in the ways that it can deal with things on their own, but also get rid of the underbrush.
Just to clarify, we're not sending the goats out into the fire. They're just eating. They were going to be eating anyway.
Yeah. It's just, we needed to clarify that because I could just see you're sending the goats to stop the fire.
Yeah, they're nowhere near the fire, but they're always hungry. They're always eating, and so they might as well eat, you know, this undergrowth needs to get removed.
So get back and help me define that four-letter word, lawn.
I guarantee it. They love it.
You mentioned a lawn, Alex, and I don't think any of us in California have had a lawn in a long time. We don't have lots big enough anymore.
Yeah, the lawn. Yeah. Well, we can get back to the lawn is from our English heritage and growing the grass out in front of the house. And so Paul has meant, we really triggered something in his mind of being able to water the lawn for free, because they've gotten it out of us in California. You know, having a lawn is, I literally had the local municipality drive up and taking pictures because they changed our water day. I hadn't changed my sprinklers, and you know, I was getting reported and was going to get fined. So to be able to water, to have a lawn, to be able to water it, to be able to water as much as you want. I actually overwatered my lawn, I found out, because I kind of went hog wild, Paul. I started watering twice a day because I saw a little bit of yellow. But
I think you got kicked out. I don't think you left voluntarily here. I'm beginning to think this was not a voluntary move on your part.
Yeah, no, I think it was probably mutual separation. There's certain people in California that are happy I left. It's worked well. Why don't we... And we could talk about this forever, but not everyone's into lawns and in that. So, but why don't we talk about Scott? How do the firm was growing? Give us a little background on Lisi Bishop and what makes it unique and how it's grown.
Absolutely.
It sounds like you guys have had some cycles here as well.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I mean, we're in the real estate business, And so traditionally, and I say traditionally, I just, you know, I've been in the business since the early 90s. Both my wife and I got in the business about the same time. And back when we got in, what you saw, and I call this old school real estate, but it still exists. You had a brokerage and then you had agents. The brokerage was, you know, the ownership, and the agents were the people out, you know, doing the business. And there was this sort of sense that it was kind of an employee-employer dynamic, even though you're, as agents, typically you're independent contractors for the most part. And but you're, if you think about it, you know, it's like, you know, think of a big brokerage, Coldwell Banker, or RE/MAX, whatever. You work at one of those firms. Your job essentially is to go out, get the business. You do all the work, but you're going to hang up their brand via their sign and their advertising wherever you go and you do this work. So you're marketing them, you're helping expand their brand, you create them, they pay you nothing. When you actually procure business, you pay them a large percentage or some percentage, or at least in the RE/MAX case, like a desk fee or rent for space. That was a little different model, but it's basically you're bringing back the bacon to them. They really risk nothing other than maybe the space, kind of a thing. So it's an interesting dynamic. And back when commission splits were relatively large in the favor of the brokerage, I mean, what a great business to be in. You know, no labor expenses. You've got these guys out busting their butts doing all this work. That did change when RE/MAX actually came into the business, because the dynamics started to change. Changed even more when Gary Keller came in the business, because he came into it and started the Keller brokerage in the 80s, I believe, mid-80s. And looked at it like, what are all these independent contractors doing, treating this business like their employees? And we got to think of this like we're business people and start to think of it that way. So going back to when we came in the business, you would have teams, but a team back then was like, hey, a couple buddies who would get together and say, hey, I'm going to be out of town this week, can you cover for me? I'll be out of town next week, can you cover me? You know, vice versa. That was about the extent of teams, at least in our market here. Gary was, you know, starting to look at things on a bigger scale, and he thought, you know, if you're going to treat this like a business, you know, what would you do? As you start to scale a business, you know, think of any even tech startup these days. You know, you're doing the coding, you're doing the work, you're doing the back end stuff, you're making it happen until you get to the point where you're like, you can't cover the business anymore. We need an assistant. We need another person to do the coding. We need another person to start shipping stuff or boxing stuff. And so you're dividing and conquering the different tasks that need to occur. So in real estate, you've got on the big picture, you're buying and you're selling properties, right? So what we started to do was look at it like, if we're going to be a business, let's divide the major tasks. The first thing we divided was buying and selling. So well, let me back up just for a second, because what happened here was we had that big downturn I mentioned. In California, you guys didn't miss it either. but when that happened, both Lisi and I were in the business separately. I was doing residential development projects. We had a little project out in Meridian, which I think we mentioned earlier, about 800 acres. Little, you know, not too little, but I mean, it was a fun project. We were selling several hundred units a year. It was glory time, really fun. Lisi was doing what I would call traditional resale real estate, which is kind of how people envision real estate. Like, hey, I want to buy a house. Can you help me find something? So that's what she was doing here locally in downtown Boise. And she had a great little business as well. When the downturn happened, people in the new construction section of the market disappeared, because their margins were immediately crushed. They basically went out of business. I mean, so it was just like you went from 100 to zero very quickly in new construction. Whereas the resale market, you can imagine, depending on when you buy a property, you may or may not have equity. If you bought it last year, you probably don't. But if you bought it 20 years ago, you're doing fine, even in a bad market. So there's still transactions happening. And Lisi's business was one where we thought, this is she's got a good, solid business. Let's build on this. And we were looking around at brokerages at the time, and Keller Williams, I'm not doing this to promote Keller Williams by any means, They were the one brokerage out there that was really looking at this as like, hey, here's a good way to build something from a single agent model, so to speak. So we leveraged their knowledge, because there were lots of people around the country that had been there and done that kind of a thing. So it was really like looking to other people's models. How did you do it? What kind of things did you use to leverage out with other people? And so the buyer agent, listing agent was the first easy one to split. The next thing you're doing is picking up, back-end help. So for example, now we get on an average probably 200 to 300 phone calls a day in and out of the office. Now, you can imagine if you're a single agent, I mean, just trying to answer the phone, let alone do business, is not going to happen. So as you scale, you realize it's an absolute necessity to be able to leverage out different components of the business. So marketing, for example, a single agent, if you got a listing or two, you can build your own flyers. You can go out and stuff your own flyer boxes. You can create your own advertising material. But when you're doing, several hundred, if not thousands of listings a year, that's something that's, you just can't do it. So for example, John is focused completely on working with buyers, which you can attest to, right? And he's not worried about the listings. He's not worried about the marketing on the back end. He's not worried about making sure that the flyers and the shoe booties are in all the listings and all that kind of stuff, because that's all just happening by other people whose task it is to manage that. He's out focused on you. And he's asking those good questions, like what are you looking for? What do you want your lifestyle to look like? How close do you want to be to the school or your work or the river, whatever that looks like for you, and really diving in. And then in a market like this, where it is fast paced on the buy side, things are listed and they're gone within minutes. You want an agent who's ahead of that and can actually find that for you. Because if you're looking on Zillow thinking you're going to get it yourself, that thing's already sold before it even hits Zillow a lot of times. So you really need somebody on the ground helping you dig in and get ahead of it.
And so, Fred, you mentioned with John focusing on buyers, is that, do you hire people in that domain, or do you find how do you determine what a broker is going to focus on?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and that goes back to when we started, we didn't really know what that looked like, other than it's like, hey, we need this filled, do that. But where we are today, we're a little more sophisticated. Anyway, we do a lot of vetting in terms of just finding out what the person's goals are, what their ambitions are, what their desires are, but then matching that with personality profiles, where we're looking at, okay, your personality profile, I mean, everybody has them, right? We're using different profiles out there, just profiles and different things that we use back end. And so you can see where people's strengths are, and you're talking to them about that. It looks like, looks like this would be a really good direction for you to go. And as long as they're aligning that with their ambitions, it can work beautifully. Where you have a disconnect, then you're trying to coach through that. Like, okay,
right?
Maybe this isn't the best place for you. So that's most of it.
When did you guys start using tools like DISC profiles and things like that?
We started using DISC about the time we came over to Keller. We've been at Keller since 2010. We came over in the middle of 2010. That was just about the bottom of the downturn. The bottom here in Boise was 2011 in terms of average price, sales price. So we started using those tools without really knowing, what we were doing with them per se. But we did know that we'd done a lot of things wrong. Like our initial inclination was to hire people we liked. Like, I like you, let's work together, And typically what you're doing when you do that is hiring, a lot of people of the same profile. And you end up having, like, I'm on the DISC profile, for anybody that knows the DISC profile, I'm a high D, which is a high driving type personality. And I like to hang out with people that are like that. I also like high I's, which are like very gregarious type people, very, very social. But you add those two things together, like nothing gets done, And so you can have a whole team of people going, yeah, great ideas. Nothing gets done in the background. And I'm that. I'm absolutely that. I mean, my wife tells me all the time, you're not an implementer. You've got to get people you got the idea, get people in to get the stuff done behind you, because otherwise it doesn't happen, which is absolutely true. I've proven that again and again and again. So I know where my faults are. But one of our philosophies is go after your strengths and not try to worry so much about the faults.
And with DISC, do you have a subscription and use everybody that comes into to the firm?
Everybody that we interview with, we have do a DISC, but we don't have a subscription. We borrow Tony Robbins for that. So thank you, Tony. We really appreciate your website. He's got a free DISC for anybody that hasn't used that before. You just go onto his site and it just spits it out into a PDF and you can look at that. that. And the DISC is like, for us, it's sort of a first blush. I mean, that just gives you, it's a real general idea of what your dominant components of your personality. And then we've got some other in-house profiles that we do that get a little more specific in terms of like job profile and that kind of stuff.
And have you seen that there's a few profiles that work as real estate agents, or you've seen ones that surprise you that, well, I didn't think you could be a good, you're not a high I, but you're
right.
You got a high C. Can you be, have you seen that, or what have you seen?
Yeah, you can see that. I mean, there's people that have higher C profiles. C and S typically fall into more of the administrative roles, I would say, typically, and they're good at that. But you can, there are people that don't have that high I or high D that can be successful at real estate because they're just methodical. I mean, at the end of the day, real estate is about getting with clients and communicating with clients and communicating information and providing them what they want. So you can't, if you're methodical and just get it done, tenacious about that, then it'll work. But it just, it's not as common, quite honestly. It's not, it's just not as obvious.
So you tell people that?
If somebody's coming in saying, hey, I want to be a buyer agent, and they've got the profile of like an accountant per se, it's usually like, I want to see some kind of track record. Like, why is this dichotomy? Why is this going to work for you? So I'm trying to think of some specific examples where I've actually seen that successfully work. I know they're out there, but I don't know if we have any in our office.
Well, Paul's got this going to break. So if any pop up, yeah. It's always interesting about what tools work and how, what people. So, Paul, if you'd like to go to break.
Imagine what it would feel like to lose everything. Your job, your home, your family, your dignity. This has happened to thousands of the men, women, veterans, and young adults we serve at Working Wardrobes. What do we do to help? We provide career development services, life skills workshops, job skills training. We provide the perfect interview outfit, and we get clients placed in jobs. Call Working Wardrobes, 714-210-2460. Donate, volunteer, invest. Higher.
And if you're trying to decide what business tool or concept to implement, like we're talking about here today, then there's a place to go, particularly if you've been frustrated by the process, or you're just looking for some insights or ideas of how to piece these tools together, what tools to pick up and how to use them and put them together effectively to change your business. There's an answer. You simply ask Vorobyev. That's right, Alex Vorobyev. Our host today was the first business advisor to focus on helping companies find and use the right tool for the right situation. If you want to learn more about how he's done it, you can simply go visit his website, confidentroi.com, and enter your question. You can even ask him, hey, Vorobyev, or call his office the old-fashioned way, 949-478-0042. That's 479-478-0042. Hey, Alex, ask Vorobyev. Hey, I got to ask Vorobyev a question here. How long ago did you move to Boise, and how did it change your business? I know it changed your life. You got, you know, obviously, it's more affordable. You get more for less money. You like the lifestyle. You know, it's a smaller, less congested. I get all of that, but how did it affect you? I think that's the fear everybody has. If I picked up my business and moved to pick any smaller community, if I decentralized and moved away, I know I can come back, but how is that? Has it hurt your business? Has it helped your business? Has it changed your business? Talk about that.
It helped my business tremendously. Before, it was kind of inevitable I'd be more Southern California centric. And moving out of Southern California obviously wasn't going to be as Southern California centric. And it changed the way I marketed and presented myself. And now it's not just a Western United States where I do some travel. Now I travel to the Midwest, and we've talked about in the past. You know, I have an international client now. I go into Mexico City, and it just changed the footprint and how I look at the world, because it's kind of natural you have a gravitation towards something, but when you're, it gives you a different perspective and a different hey, there's more out there. And there's different, and you got to do things differently than you did in the past. It's not necessarily just networking with your immediate network.
Do you still have to, though, maintain kind of local presence and different things? Obviously, I'm looking, what started this is you still have a local Orange County phone number here. And I'm sure you have other phone numbers, too, for different areas and whatnot. Do you have to have kind of a feeling of a local presence there? Or is it...
Yeah, it's easier than ever for people to have a connection with you because of, you know, the podcast and mm-hmm. the web presence, that area codes aren't as important as they once were. People are more interested in connecting with you and having a conversation. So that hasn't... The fact that I'm not everywhere... people don't look at it. They're able to connect with you a lot easier now than they were in the past.
And they don't look at it and say, gee, I'm going to find the local accountant before I go to the virtual accountant. They don't care as long as you can both, because they feel as connected to the virtual accountant as perhaps as they do to the guy.
People want to connect and they want to feel that. And I think that's where we're talking with our guests today, Scott Bishop and John Vander Giesen. It's connecting with people and having that connection is really the essential for growing things. And what you're hearing the story from Scott and how, and want to share that, have him share the story about how they grew their business into more than higher than the top, just the top 10 in terms of its position in its firm that it's with on a national basis. But there's a story there, and so I wanted him to share that on how you developed it and what was important along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so maybe to give some perspective to some of the things we've been saying. I mean, when we started in the real estate business, it was literally sort of the calculus was, how do we put groceries on the table? You know, it was like we had a newborn child. We just needed to eat. I was actually still in school. Lisi was, you know, feeling like she had just had to go out and do something. I wasn't apparently providing enough quickly enough. And so she went out and got her real estate license. We went to the classes at the same time. She actually got licensed first and started working literally with our newborn on her hip out, you know, trying to get business. And we were young, so people weren't really paying attention to us or taking her for a serious player. But and then I shortly followed into the same office, and we just started working. And initially, we did work. We thought we'd be like this husband and wife team. That was the idea. That lasted a very short period of time because we're both high D personalities, going back to that DISC profile, which means we kind of both think we're running things, and we decided we better run things separately. So that's when I started going new construction and ended up working with developers and builders, and Lisi did the more traditional route. So we stayed on that sort of mode for the first, you know, decade, I guess, of the journey. Then when the crash came, that really created another sense of urgency. We were both successful at that time. We did have, fast forward to when we had savings. You know, things were good. But it was clear that the world was changing, or had changed rather quickly. And so what did we need to do now? And I think it really went from almost, in my mind, the way I remember it, it was like we were just not working smart. We were just doing it. We were making great money, but it wasn't like we were thinking, wow, we really got to leverage this and hire people and build this and create something bigger. It's like, man, we were just cruising, doing what we were doing. When the new construction went away, which it did, it was like somebody shut the tap off on your spigot. It was kind of like, wow, okay, we really got to salvage or focus on this resale business. What does that look like? And that's where we started really thinking about building it as a business and as something that could be bigger than us, for sure. And my primary focus at that time was really to get it so that it was bigger than Lisi, because she was doing all the work at that time on her business. And I was like, man, this is crazy, you know, because it was a hard time. She would get on 10 listing appointments to procure probably one listing, literally because people were so far underwater that it was like, you know, they were just giving it back to the bank more than they were doing anything else. So to find that one person with equity, you had to go on several appointments. And we took, it was interesting because the short sale business in Boise was 50% of short sale, meaning people selling below negative equity or giving it back to the bank. Those two things, so bank owned and short sales, were over 50, I think it got up to like almost 70% of the transactions during the years between 2009 and 2011 or 12.
Wow.
11 was the bottom. So that's a lot of business. A lot of age. Well, and the agent count in our valley was about 12,000, went down to about less than 3,000. I think it was like 2,700. So it was like rats fleeing the ship. You know, when times were good, they were coming on kind of like they are now. We've got hundreds of agents coming in every day. And they were going out by the thousands back then. And so kind of last track.
I've got a quick point on this, and something I've always appreciated from like a business development perspective is that when things got very difficult in their industry, Scott and Lisi expanded into that retraction, and rather than a lot of people, they just pull the stakes and they're out and they're going to go find something else because it's difficult. They decided to take territory at that point in time and really run forward with the business. You know, everybody's running out of the burning building and they were going in. And that paid off immensely from my perspective in being in the business for 3 years with them because they gained market share in a very difficult time and they had much more momentum once things started to recover. Onto the, you know, the good times that we're experiencing right now. So that was an interesting point is that they said, well, this is, you know, this wind is blowing against us all. What are we going to do with it?
And so how did that look like? How did you expand into contraction?
Yeah. So like I mentioned, people were fleeing the ship and just to give you sort of an analogy on that, the newspaper, our local newspaper is the Idaho Statesman that services the area. They had what they called at that time, prior to the crash, the Real Estate Review, which was an insert that they put in on Saturdays. It was almost as thick as a phone book at some time. I mean, it was just crazy. Everybody was in that thing. You know, you had something to sell. All the subdivisions were in there. After the crash, that eliminated or just disappeared because they didn't have enough people to fill it. There were a couple of local offices that thought, well, if that's gone, we got to create our own insert. So that happened. And we decided at that time to continue advertising. So we were one of the few agents, individual agents, that would put money into print advertising. Nobody else did. It became non-existent almost. And of course, at the same time, we had, you know, everybody thinking the internet was the next, you know, coming, right? So everybody thought they were going to get all their leads from the internet, which was not bad. It's just, you know, they were missing a big part of the equation. From our perspective, we were like, you know, this is fabulous. You know, everybody thinks the newspaper doesn't work anymore. Nobody's reading it. This is great. And you know, obviously readership's going down. Papers are struggling. Newsprint's been a struggling thing. But when you look at the numbers, I mean, it's like, are you kidding me? What, you know?
Did you see results right away when you guys were
I mean, it was significant. I mean, we were, because if you think about it, you have to sell your house. Back in those days, it's not because you're thinking, wow, I get to run to the bank and cash a big check. It's like, I got to get out of town. I got to get rid of this mortgage. I got to move this thing. So you're taking it seriously. Like you're looking around going, who's going to market this? Because I don't want to just give this to my cousin Jimmy that just got his license last month and doesn't know how to market anything. You got to get this thing sold. So we were literally standing there, you know, advertising, we're selling houses and nobody else was. So the business, yeah, it just grew. And we've continued to, you know, take that approach. And I think it's interesting because even as good as this market is, the newspaper print hasn't come back. There's very few people that are playing in that field. And, you know, we travel around other markets and I'm always curious to see, you know, what that looks like too. And it's really, there's not a lot of presence in the paper for people marketing real estate. And I think there's a huge market out there. I mean, it's, you know, millennials maybe aren't reading so much, but there's a lot of people that have a lot of housing that still read the paper.
It sounds crazy, but I, you know, our firm does at least 44 open houses a year as far as open house weekend tour. So that means that we have a minimum of 6, sometimes 10 new homes every weekend where thousands of people know about us and come to it. You know, I've got friends that just pop in to say hi and want to see homes. And, you know, I became friends with them because they like our open house tour. That's a big machine. So, I mean, that's an interesting dynamic there too, where it was Scott and Lisi, and now there's thousands of people coming to our open house and you ask, how did you hear about us? And they say, oh, the paper, of course, because we're the only thing in the real estate insert now. And, you know, people laugh about the paper because it's kind of seems archaic, but, you know, this little boutique firm in Boise, you know, we're number 6 in the world with Keller Williams International. because of that marketing presence and a lot of the other things of, as far as the client experience. And the client experience is actually why I'm here, because I was just surveying the landscape of real estate, trying to figure out why people joined teams, why people went to X brokerage. And Scott and I started to meet and talk. And I finally was just so curious about what they were doing at such a high level. I said, well, what is it that you're focused on? And he said, the client experience. And at that point in time, that was the defining moment of me knowing that I had to be in this ship because it was going in the direction I wanted to go. And it's held true since. So everything that we do, the fact that we have way more admin than we do have agents, that's all geared towards a client experience.
Yeah. Expand on that. What? How do you guys define client experience?
Well, so, you know, it really all started with, you know, Lisi's dedication to the client. And that goes back to just how, when we went into the business, we were, like I said earlier, we were broke, didn't have two quarters rubbed together. And you could easily imagine where if you had a client that was about to close a house and something's going wrong, you're just like, let's just get the house closed. I don't care what's going wrong. But our approach was always whatever's best for the client, whatever's best for you. So you had to just bury that financial component. That did not matter and should never matter to a good agent. Of course, it's a lot easier when you've got, you know, 50, 60 transactions closing this week or this month than it is when you've got no transactions closing or one. But we still had that mindset from early on that it's like, it's all about the client. How would you want it to look if it were you in that same seat? And so we've started with that and then just continued to raise the bar. So it's always, how can we make this better? How can we make this service better? How can we make the system better so that the client's better served at the end of the day? And that's just been that's the basis of it. So we never sacrifice the client experience for growth. And we've had good growth despite that. But I guarantee you, if we were not of that mindset, especially in this upturn, we could have grown it a lot faster. But the collateral damage that I feel we would have through a poor customer experience is not worth it. Because if you're trying to build a long-term perpetual income machine or perpetual business machine, you want to have good outputs, because good outputs create more good inputs. You know, a happy client is going to bring their friends and other clients. And that's literally how we operate. Other than obviously we're doing a lot of marketing, which brings in people that are outside of that knowledge component. But really the core of it is people that know about us and have heard about us and know how we provide value for them.
Well, yeah, when I bought a house and used your firm, it was very, when we opened escrow, I was introduced to someone who was going to, I think it called it managing your transaction team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Transaction coordinator.
Your transaction coordinator. And can you describe what they do, John?
Yeah. So as soon as we get under contract and we're moving towards the inspection period and we're just in escrow, we've got to hand it over to a transaction coordinator. And that person is going to team up with the buyer or seller. They're also going to team up with the title agency, their financing organization, if they're financing the deal, the listing or the other agent on the other side of the transaction. And they're the eye in the sky on all of those moving parts, because there are a number of different things that happen in a transaction after we're under contract, and you need to hit timelines. You need to keep the ship going in the right direction. And unfortunately, some people, there's human error, and some people just aren't very professional and they drop things. And so having that transaction coordinator has saved a deal very often, and that directly impacts that client experience.
Because the agent isn't always at their desk. And
absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, like you could have the greatest agent in terms of knowledge, response, you know, all the things that you want. But if they're tied up with another client in a closing right now and you need something, then that you're going into voicemail. They're not going to be able to help you for X number of hours. So we've basically, our intention is to always have somebody there that can take care of you. So the transaction coordinators are here all day long. We've got two right now that are dedicated to the buyer side, two that are dedicated to the listing side of the transaction. So we've even divided that. And while John's out working with you, say in Eagle, looking at property, and you guys are out, you know, tromping through the ditches and looking at the irrigation, somebody else might be calling in saying, hey, I'm calling about, you know, John's transaction on XYZ property. You know, what can you tell me about this, know, what do I need to bring to closing or whatever? And there's somebody that's going to be here to answer that question for them.
Yeah. And one thing, I'd be remiss if I didn't add this in as far as client experience and what that means. I think that a lot of people in business miss the fact that it's unique to the client. It's not that we're boxing a client experience and saying, here, Alex, this is your client experience. You better like it. We're saying through asking great questions, you know, what's going to be important to you? How do I win with you? What at the end of this transaction, what do you want to see? You know, what is that experience? Then tell me about that. And really asking qualifying questions to get a great grasp. And then we're able to deliver that. That's an important differentiation.
Well, I can attest to that. You've asked questions to triangulate me, but how can people get in touch with you if they're interested in learning more?
Yeah, absolutely. So our website is lysibishop.com. That's spelled LYSIBISHOP. So it's not necessarily phonetic. Lots of people have problems with that name, Lisi. And then our phone number here just directly into the office is area code 208-472-5337. So those are two easy ways to find us. And I don't know, is there any other
way? We'll have all your contact information, the show notes pages as well, and the email address and website.
Excellent.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on, guys. It's been very educational, and I've learned more that I live in a French colony now.
Thank you, Alex.
Oui, oui, parlez-vous français?
You've been listening to another episode of Confident ROI, brought to you by the good folks, Alex Verrobio, Confident ROI Magazine, right here in Orange County's only community radio station, OCTalkRadio.net.